first speaker, Rashima P. from Frederick area.
Yeah, Rashima!
I'm an addict named Rashima.
Hey, Rashima.
Hi, family. Wow. First, I want to thank my friend Troy and the rest of the programming subcommittee for asking me to come out and do a workshop in Ocean City this year. It really, really, really is an honor and a privilege to be asked to do a workshop. And I try to do it whenever I can, because just how dare I not give back to the program and the people that have given my life back to me. So that's just how I was taught. When you're asked if you can do it, do it, and make it happen if you can. And speaking in Ocean City is particularly special to me. This convention, it's my 18th one, and this convention is, it's just close to my heart. It was the first convention that I ever went to, Narcotics Anonymous, and when I came that year, the path of my recovery totally changed. And it went in a different direction, and I got, more serious and more focused, and, I truly believe that the things that I heard that year, and the way that I heard it from those exact people that I heard it from, are why I'm here today. It just put me on a path of recovery that I hadn't been on before. And then I woke up this morning, and I was just, I got, tears of gratitude, because, I woke up, and I was so peaceful and so content, where I was in my life right in that moment. And don't get me wrong, it didn't last forever, that peace and contentment, because that's just not the kind of addict that I am. I'm more of, a worrier. I gotta do stuff, I gotta push stuff and make it work and do it my way and fuss and fret and do all that. But, for first 15 minutes this morning, I was just peaceful and content. And that's something that, recognizing that in the moment is something that, I've not always been able to do. And I've learned that over the years, and I've learned that through living the foundation that I've built, that, I need to recognize those times and kind of hold on to them. Because don't get me wrong, my life is not perfect. It's not, easy and simple. Life on life's terms, I think, in general, is difficult. It's very difficult to stay clean through life on life's terms. And our recovery might be simple, but it's definitely not easy. And so I try to hold on to those moments when I have them. So I think my story starts in October 30th, 1972. It's my birthday. But actually, I really think it starts probably decades before that. My father is an addict. My mother is a flaming codependent. And my mother's father was an addict, and my grandmother was a flaming codependent. So, I do believe that I was born an addict. I was born with a propensity that if the right chemicals were introduced to my physical body, the disease would take off and the compulsion would begin, and there I would go. And that is how it went down. I used a little bit in high school. To me, it was pretty much the same way my friends were using. I don't know that the problem had taken off at that point. When I was 20 years old, I had a really, really, really bad, horrific car accident. And I was in a high-speed collision on the highway head-on. And I woke up in a hospital with two broken legs, wrist, elbow, jaw, ankle, fractured skull, teeth knocked out. And I was a bit of a mess. And during the time in that hospital, at one point, they had introduced me to my drug of choice. And I remember the exact moment when they gave me that shot and the feeling that came over me that, I can't walk, I look like crap, God only knows what's going to happen in my world, but it's all okay. They put that chemical in my system and it was like, everything's going to be just fine, no biggie. And from that point forward, for the next several years, I tried to continue to feel that way. Every day, every night, all the time. That's what I did. I chased that feeling. And, I started out, I was 20 years old. I started out with just prescription drugs. And, eventually that just became so much of a hassle to have to lie and get drugs and say I was hurt when I wasn't and have surgery. It was so much easier to, cop on the street and get street drugs. So when I figured that out, then my addiction really went flying and progressed pretty quickly for me. You know, I went from sniffing stuff up my nose to shooting it straight into my veins with a needle. And I remember when I made that jump, thinking, you know, if I put a spike in my arm, I will probably never, ever, ever come back from being a useless dope fiend junkie. And I did it anyway. And, you know, things progressed pretty quickly for me. I became a slave to my disease, whatever it said, you know, to do more, get more, stay high, stay numbed out, do it. It didn't matter what my morals were, didn't matter what my values were, didn't matter what I was taught. None of it mattered. Whatever I was supposed to do, what am I supposed to do? How to jump? How high? You know, lie to who? Steal what? From where? I did it. And at the end, I only saw two options. I had been to treatment a couple times, and it didn't really, you know, stick. I never really wanted to get clean at those points. Like, my parents made me go. I want to get my car back, or I got in trouble at school. So I didn't think that I could get clean. I didn't think it was possible for me. I really thought, you know, I took that step in the way that I use, and I'm just done. Like, there's no hope for me. So using wasn't stopping wasn't an option. I couldn't continue to use because it was killing me physically and emotionally and spiritually. You know, I couldn't even look in the mirror. Every day I woke up, I wished I was dead. Every time I stuck a spike in my arm, I wish it was the last time. And I just, the things I had to do to ways and means to get more and stay high were just, the price was just so high for me. I just couldn't, I wasn't built like that. I just couldn't keep going. So continuing to use wasn't an option. So that left me with what I thought was my only option, and that was to kill myself. And I really did think that was the only thing. Earlier in my addiction, after the car accident, I had made a suicide attempt. I took 30 morphine sulfates and 20 Dilaudids, and my parents found me. I'm an only child. I forgot that part. I'm an only child, so self-centeredness and the world revolving around me is like, yeah, that's my way of life. And my mom's an only child, too, so only child, only grandchild. And my parents found me, you know, blue lips and, you know, not breathing, and they called an ambulance. And I had this audacious self-centeredness and total lack of concern for anybody but myself that I yelled at them when I woke up. I cussed them out for calling 911 and saving their daughter's life. Like, it still, like, kills me that I did that. Like, I have kids now. And that's just, I don't know how I could be that way, but that's where the disease took me. And so, you know, toward the end of my using, I'm thinking about killing myself via suicide, and I remembered that. I remembered how I did that to them. And I don't know, I just stopped, and I had my first conscious contact with God, my understanding. And I didn't recognize it at the time as that being what it was, but just a little voice in my head that said, try treatment one more time. Go to, you know, see if you can get clean one more time. Your dad did it. Because my dad did get into recovery when I was about 15. And I called home and I said, I want to come back. I used in Philadelphia, and I came back to Frederick, and I didn't just, you know, come home and get clean. You know, I got in an outpatient thing. I got on a drug replacement therapy, and I'm not saying that because I endorse it or anything. I'm just saying it because that's my story. I was on that for a little while before I actually got off of it and got my white key tag and was clean for real. But I came home and I did that, and you know, in the early parts, just going to outpatient, they kept saying, go to NA, this and that. And I'm like, yeah, no. I don't think I want to do that. Frederick's too small. People will see me. They'll know. And someone invited me to a dance. And I was like, all right, maybe I can do a dance. So I go to a dance, and I met some people at this dance. I met a guy, and he introduced me to some women. You know, he did what you're supposed to do, men, if you didn't know that. He took the cute girl over to a bunch of women and said, here, she's new. And they did what they were supposed to do, too. You know, they hugged me, loved me, said, let's go to a meeting tomorrow. And, you know, that's how I started going to meetings. And it wasn't like I had it in my head. I had a vision in my head that, you know, drug addicts look like this, they talk like this, they did these chemicals. And no, you guys didn't all look just like me. You didn't all talk just like me. You didn't all go to the same college I went to or have the same financial upbringing or whatever. Like, that wasn't all the same, but you guys felt like I felt. You knew how it felt to be at the end of the road with nowhere else to go. Well, what is there left to do? Either go on to the bitter ends or find a new way to live. I love that reading. You guys knew that. You understood that. And you had, like, the golden ticket. Because for a long time at the end of my using, I wanted to stop. I just didn't know how. And I didn't think that I could. And you guys had the answer. You knew how to stop. And more importantly, how to stay stopped. And when I got here, I just jumped in with both feet. And I finally felt like I fit in. Even though, like I said, you didn't look like me or talk like me or whatever, you felt the way I did. And I felt like I fit in, finally. And I have this dorky little button that I love. It's our symbol. And the pin says, square pegs do fit in round holes. Because that's what our symbol is. And that's how I felt. Like, never felt like I fit in until I got here. And I was so fortunate that in early recovery, I went back home to my parents. I'm a spoiled rotten brat. I didn't have to, like, work and be financially self-sufficient or any of that stuff. And I got to just stay in meetings constantly and go to speakers jams and go to conventions and do service and get plugged in and meet some people and build a network and start practicing some spiritual principles that have been building my foundation, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. You know, it was easy for me to be honest with the fact that I was an addict. It was painfully obvious that, like, once I started, I could not stop. That part was really easy for me. And in the beginning, open-mindedness was really easy for me, too, because, like I said, you guys had all the answers. And everyone was, not everyone was so peaceful and happy, but I had, like, you know, I was on a pink cloud. I spent my whole first year, I think, on a pink cloud. And my ears were open, my mind was open. I listened to what you guys said, and I was everywhere getting different information. And you know, the willingness wasn't hard for me either in the beginning, you know, because I did not want to get high anymore. I hated, I mean, it was just the worst for me. And somebody told me if I worked half as hard in my recovery as I did at getting high, I'd be all right. And I took it to heart, and I tried to work at least as hard at my recovery as I did at getting high. And I worked damn hard to get high. So I worked damn hard in recovery. I did a lot of meetings, a lot of stuff. And when I had 60 days, I came here for my first convention, CPRC in A10, We Are a Vision of Hope. And I saw a woman speak. Her name's Janet G. I forget which area, Bayside or West Side or something. And she told me what I needed to hear. Because at 60 days, I was doing all this stuff. I was going to meetings. I was doing this and doing that. But there was some stuff I really didn't want to do. I really didn't want a sponsor. And I really couldn't find the perfect sponsor that had A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And she stood up there and she had 13 years clean, did the relationships meeting, and she said, you know, we always say there are no musts in NA, but if you want what I have, you have to do what I did. And I'm like, all ears, what is it? And she said, five things. Go to meetings, many, many meetings, way more than a meeting a day. And like, well, she said a meeting a day for way more than 90 days, like 3 to 5 years, do a meeting a day. So make meetings, lots of meetings, work steps with a sponsor, get a relationship with God in your understanding, and do some service. That is how I work this program. Those are the actions that I take to build my foundation. From that point on, that's what I've done. That's what I did then. That's the way I work this program to this day. You know, in the beginning, that's how I built my foundation, but now I still do those things to reinforce my foundation. Because it won't, you know, once I get it put together, if I don't take care of it, it'll fall apart. You know, so those are the things that I still do. And, you know, that first year, I did the 1-2-3 shuffle. You know, I do steps 1-2-3, change sponsors. Do steps 1-2-3. Change sponsors. So I do, the how and why says that the first three steps are a foundation. So I had a good long 365 days approximately to work on my foundation. And, you know, like I said, step one was pretty easy for me. It was obvious. I knew I had acceptance of my disease wasn't hard for me because it was just so painfully obvious how screwed up I was and how screwed up my life was that I got brought to here. And that part wasn't hard for me to understand. I had the acceptance that's, you know, required to work the first step. And in having that acceptance, I learned that I had to surrender. And I didn't like that word surrender. I still don't really like it. For me, I had to switch it a little bit. And to me, I surrender to the principles of this program. And in doing that, I fight and beat the disease every single day. That's how I see surrender. I surrender to the positive. I surrender to the spiritual principles. I surrender to going to a meeting when I really don't want to fucking go to a meeting. I surrender to, you know, sometimes sponsoring people when I don't want to. you know, and I surrender to this program by doing service when I don't want to. And still, those five things, those five actions. So that was, that part was good. But also in that first year, doing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You know, I did step two. I did just like the basic text says, passed over with minimum concern, got to three, was like, what? Turn it over? No way, I can't do that because I didn't do what I was supposed to do in step two. And after I did it three times, I finally got it. But I had like a breakthrough with that because I always, it was easy for me to see how insane my life had been when I was using. And that and into coming into recovery, I was restored to sanity. That part was easy. What I didn't get was how if I learned how to ask for help when I needed it, because I can still go to a place of insanity in recovery, and I can still be restored to sanity in recovery. Like, I didn't, I thought it was like a one-time thing. I was insane, now I'm not. And I had to, you know, be here for a little while and do some crazy shit. Just, oh, right, okay. I can still be crazy in recovery, and I can still need to be restored to sanity in recovery. And so I had to figure that out and, you know, learn to have a little bit of hope that, you know, something bigger than me, something better than me can help me if I just, like, stop trying to force it and ask for the help. And that's kind of where step three comes in. I struggle with two. I struggle with three. You know, I'm a control freak. Just the way it is. I want to, you know, I want, and I know what I want. I'm not a wishy-washy person that doesn't know what they want. I know what the hell I want, and I am going to go get it. I don't care how bad it is for me. I want it. It's mine. I'm going to get it. And, you know, God doesn't always agree with that. That's not always the plan. So, you know, I had to learn to not get so caught up in what's God's will and what's not God's will and what should I. I had a hard time with the footwork because step three is an action step. Like, you got to do some work in step three. It's not, to me, it's not just about letting go. It's about, you know, doing God's will and learning what God's will is also. So I had to find a way to just, for me, whenever there's something going on, I have to do everything I can possibly do. And once I've done all that, then I can step back and say, okay, God, I did everything I could do. Now you do your part. And, you know, I had to go through a lot of different things to learn that, you know, the God of my understanding does have my best interests at heart. You know, I don't always get what I want. I don't pray and ask for help and get what I want. I pray and ask for help and I get through things. You know, I guess, what my HP thinks I need. It's still hard for me to see I get what I need. Because a lot of that stuff I got, I really feel like I didn't really need that. I didn't really need that lesson. I didn't really need that pain. But whatever, that's what I got. And, you know, I made my choices, that's what I got. And, you know, that's how God took me through my process to, you know, learn to have some faith and learn that I can get through stuff and survive it. So, yeah, my first year of recovery was awesome. And then after that, like the next 2 to 5 years were, I worked 4 through 12. And for me, that was all about learning about who I am and learning how to work the spiritual principles through working the steps. You know, being honest in my 4-step. Oh, the other awesome thing about this meeting is I get to share with my sponsor, which is the coolest thing ever. And, but I did, you know, I did a 4-step and a 5th step, and I had enough trust in someone else that I could open my heart and open my mouth and talk about all that stuff and get some cleansing. And I had an epiphany the night I was done. I was going over it the next day. I just woke up and I was thinking about all the stupid crap I did in my life. So all this cruddy things, all people I hurt, the ways I hurt myself, the mistakes I made, all this shit that I regretted. And I was crying, and I had another conscious contact with my God, and it was like, I forgive you. Forgive yourself. And I still struggle with it. I still struggle with it to this day. And God forbid, now that I have kids, I make a mistake and they cry or they're hurt in some way and I know I'm wrong. Forgiveness is just, it's hard. But, you know, it's another part of my foundation, spiritual, you know, principles that I try to work and live by. 6 and 7, not fun, you know. That was not fun for me. Was not digging it. Thank you. But, you know, I got to learn about myself. I got to learn about all my screw-ups and whatever. And for me, it was very painful. Becoming willing to humbly ask for them to be removed, and I had to be beat down so bad that I didn't feel like I could go on, almost as bad as, like, you know, the end of my using. Please, God, take this away. It hurts so bad. And, yeah, that was how it was for me. But after that, you know, I had a few really great years where I felt like I was living the dream. I had a beautiful house. I had who I thought was an awesome husband. I had these beautiful kids. And I got there, and I shared how grateful I was all the time. And the floor fell out, and my husband got high, and I didn't have a job. I had a 2-year-old and a 2-month-old. And that's when the strong foundation came into play. Where all those years before, when I went to meetings when I didn't want to go, when things were good, I still did what I was supposed to do. When I stayed vigilant and did things when my life was screwed up, when I stayed vigilant and did things when my life was good, the foundation was there. And I didn't have to pick up over it, even though I was so hopeless. Like, I felt so hopeless about where I was going. That wasn't what I wanted. And my network held me up. You know, that's part of my foundation, too, is the relationships I've built here. And, you know, I survived it. I stayed clean. Things weren't perfect. I mean, things changed and whatever, and, you know, I survived it. And, you know, now I'm still going through kind of hard times in recovery. But you know what? The little struggles I have today about money, relationships, whatever, it's nothing compared to waking up dope sick. It's nothing compared to finding ways and means to get more. It's nothing like it. I never have to do that again, and neither do you. That is our message. No addict seeking recovery need ever die. You know, we can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. It can be done. If you don't believe it, just stay. Just stay. Meet some people. Let them tuck you under. Go where they go. Do what they do. And just all the other stuff will come is simple. Just if I don't put it in me, I will not get high. You know, and my life will get better. And my life is better today. I was telling someone, I have a beautiful life today. I have beautiful people in my life. I have people who really love me and care about me and support me and are here for me. Even when I do stupid shit, they still love me. So, you know, that's kind of my view on building a foundation. I will keep coming back. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Rashima. Our second speaker today is Linda B. from the West Side area.
Good morning. I, too, want to thank Troy, and it's awesome to be here at the convention. My first convention was at More Will Be Revealed, the first convention for this first convention. And I have been coming back since, except I've missed many conventions because I lived in Arizona for about 9 years. And I just feel really grateful to be here today. And I purposely didn't ask what the topic was until, I don't know, a few days ago, and so I wouldn't obsess about it. And so I started obsessing about it. And then something kind of amazing happened. And I wasn't sure if I was going to share this first or not, but I will, and then I'll backtrack, because obviously that's what I'm supposed to do. I came down to Bethany Beach on Wednesday night because Thursday morning, my sister, who's up here in the front row, celebrated 30 years. And amazing, amazing. And at that meeting, my father shared. And my father doesn't always share. He supports us. He's been supporting us for many years now, but he doesn't openly share in meetings very often. And he did, and he said his name, and he said, "I'm a recovering family member." And he proceeded to share about his anger. And he proceeded to talk about that he was very angry. And he was very angry. And it's hard for me to actually say this because I have never heard my father say what he said like he did. We've made amends to each other. We've sat at a table and we've talked about some terrible things that have happened. But he just talked about himself and he talked about how he didn't know why he was so angry and why he reacted the way that he did. And the reality is my father had a wife that was an addict, his oldest daughter, addict, next daughter, addict, next son, addict, youngest son, addict. And that doesn't justify the way that my father reacted in our family because it was not a pretty picture at all. This is a man who I snuck out of the house at 12, 13 years old and was out getting high and came into the house and my mother was sitting on my bed in the dark room, scared the you-know-what out of me. My father was on a business trip and came home from that business trip and proceeded to rip my room apart. Rip it apart. Broken Alice Cooper records. Okay, I can laugh about that now. That was my first album, by the way. Welcome to my Nightmare was my very first album. Now, that should have said, I've shared this before, that should have told me something right off the bat, right? That someone should have just checked me into treatment right then. And, anyways, he tore the room up. I mean, candles. It was smashed. And then he brought a big trash can in from outside, and he said, clean this up. And that was just one example. In my act of addiction, I started at 12 years old, and my first drug was a six-pack of Colt 45 underneath the bridge in Rockville, Maryland. And my addiction took off rapidly. I felt that feeling, and let me go back for a minute. My first drug was not that beer. My first drug was a drug called chlorotrimetan, and it's an allergy medicine, and it came in a brown bottle. And my mom would give me my dose of allergy medicine because I would get that allergy where, you know, your eyes crust over really bad, and she would have to give me the allergy medicine. And after she would give me the allergy medicine, I would go find the bottle in the medicine cabinet and then drink it. And I thought, at that age, I mean, I was, what, 6, 7, 8, I thought, man, this tastes really good. This tastes great. It was green, really pretty bluish-green color. The truth is, it was making me feel really good inside. And I wanted to get rid of my feelings from the get-go. My mom was an addict. I didn't understand that growing up. The only thing I understood when I put chemicals in my body was that I did not have to feel anymore. And I proceeded from the age of 12 till 21 to try to find oblivion all the time. And I was successful most of the time. My drug of choice was not only more, but it was whatever you had. And I didn't care. I just put it in my mouth. And or put it up my nose or whatever. My father, when I was about 15 years old, and we had already had many physical fights, that incident that happened in my bedroom was just one of many. But the worst was I was very high off of many things, and I was telling my mother I was going out at midnight because I thought that made a lot of sense. And my father came out of his bedroom and proceeded to put me on the ground, put his arms around my neck, and was strangling me. And I got away, and I left my family home at that point, and I did not go back again until after I finished treatment. And I swear, some of you that are here, a lot of you haven't met my father, but a lot of you have met my father. And I know that you think that is totally and absolutely impossible. Because when you meet my father, he's very kind, he's very quiet. He'd do anything for me or anyone else, and you would not imagine that. And I share this about my father even because that is part of what this program's all about, because he started getting recovery for himself, and he is a totally different person. And on Thursday morning, when he shared what he shared, I just looked at my father, and I looked at my mother and my sister, and then I looked at myself, and I'm like, you know, I don't like to use the word miracle lightly, but we really are. I mean, it's just amazing. We really are. Building a foundation. I didn't know anything about building a foundation, and I didn't even know I had a foundation until I was 3 years and 9 months clean. At 3 years and 9 months clean, I got a phone call as I was walking into my apartment from an NA meeting, and I picked up the phone, and someone had said they had heard my brother's name over the scanner. And I proceeded to pick up my telephone and call my parents' house, and my parents' house was literally like 2 minutes up the house from where I was living, and the line was busy. And I knew, because when I knew something was wrong, and I went up there, and my youngest brother, Michael, had been in a serious car accident. Self-induced drunk driving accident, four guys, he was in the back seat, his head was crushed, the car flipped end over end 4 or 5 times. My father, my mother, my brother, and myself proceeded to drive to Shock Trauma in Baltimore, and they told us that he wasn't going to live. And I said goodbye to him with a toe tag on his toe, with his head covered, and with the monitors all over the place. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I proceeded for the next, I don't know how many weeks, to be carried by the people in my network. Carried by the people in my network. I mean, literally picked up at the house, my parents' house, and driven to meetings because I didn't want to go to meetings. And then, sorry, I go through these. Anyone that's heard me share, I'll like stop and go, okay, where am I going now? And no, it's not because I'm going to be 50 in a few months. I remember the funeral. I remember the funeral, and I remember looking out in the church, and I remember just looking at people that had been in meetings and just were there for us. And that's when I knew that I had a foundation. And that foundation came from, number one, going to meetings. Meetings, meetings, meetings. Like Rashima, I went to meetings all the time. Because when you all told me to go to meetings, I took you seriously, because when I was not in a meeting, I was up in my head. And when I was up in my head in early recovery, I just thought about using. And if I didn't think about using, I was thinking about something else to get out of myself. Buying CDs, or albums. I don't think CDs had came out yet. Okay, they were almost coming out. But I went to just meeting after meeting after meeting. I mean, I don't know anything about 90 and 90, and this is just how it worked for me. I went to a meeting every day for a long time. I remember having, 4 months clean, and I was sick. And at the time, I was living with my parents, and I was up. I got up. I had a fever. And my mother said, "You need to go back to bed." I said, "No, I have to go to a meeting. I can't miss a meeting. I haven't missed a meeting in 4 months." And she convinced me to go back to bed and said it would be okay. Meetings. Service work was next for me, because the people around me, when I first got clean, they gave me positions. I was appointed my first sponsor because I didn't know how to ask, and I was also appointed every service position I had in the first year. And I had a service position in, seriously, probably at least 5 meetings out of the week. People were giving, at 5 months clean, people were giving me the treasurer money. You know, and I was working at McDonald's. Best job I've ever had still to this day. And they were giving me money, and I'd be lying if I told you I never tapped into that money. You know what I mean? I didn't have gas money, so I'd be like tapping in $10, you know, then I'd put $10 back. In early recovery, when I was tapping into the money, I would forget how much I owed it. I'll tell you, treasury is not my favorite job. But I learned how to socialize and how to count money and how to be responsible and how to count scoops of coffee. I learned all that in early recovery, which, believe it or not, all that transferred into, like, learning how to, like, just be human, just be without using drugs on a daily basis. Because I do believe that when I started using at 12, I stunted my growth mentally, spiritually, and physically. And I had to learn all of that all over again. And sponsorship, both having a sponsor and being a sponsor, started for me very early. Very early. There was a lot of young people in the Frederick area, and they asked me to be their sponsor before I even finished working through the 12 steps. And truthfully, when I think about my recovery, I don't know how it would have been without that. I really don't. I mean, you know, it motivated me because my sponsees would start getting farther and farther with the steps, you know. And my sponsor in the beginning had me work the 12 steps through, like, within 14 months. But when you start sponsoring someone, like, at 8-9 months and they start getting closer and closer, you're like, oh, I've got to hurry up. So it can be a motivator to have sponsees. My brother's death has, for me, been the hardest thing I've had to get through. The second hardest thing I've had to get through was the death of my sister's child. And I lived in Arizona at the time, and my sister had had multiple miscarriages, and finally she had carried a child all the way through, but he was premature. And I had already bought presents and everything, and then I got the call that it wasn't going to be okay and that he was going to die. And I remember going to the church nearby, which I didn't go to. I don't go to church anymore. But I remember going into the church, and I just remember praying and saying, take me instead of him, and those kind of things. And I got a plane ticket home to Maryland, and I walked in the door, and the next hardest thing I've ever heard in my life besides my mother after my brother died was listening to my sister's tears and sobs. And to this day, I still am amazed that she was able to get through that time. And because you can't do anything. You can't do anything except be there. You just can't do anything but be there and love people. And that's what reminds me of the other part of my foundation, and that's the love that we all share. And we all have our differences. You know, when I come here, I'm dealing with personalities. I'm staying in people's rooms, and we're dealing with personalities. But I'm talking about the love. I'm not talking about the other stuff like, oh, where are you going to dinner? Oh, I thought you were going to go to the convention center. Oh, you know, where you go through all that stuff. I'm talking about that deep love that I feel for all of you because of the common bond that we share. And not a lot of people have that. And the biggest part of my foundation today has been learning how to care about myself and to love myself. And you all have taught me how to do that. Because without that, I am that little girl at 12 years old that has no self-esteem, that can't look in the mirror, that will do anything for you because I want you to like me. Today's reading, just for today, was on people-pleasing. Oh, that's, like, so the core for me. It's been one of the main things. It's been the toughest thing I've had to work on in my recovery. It's just remembering that I don't have to do anything for anyone. I need to take care of myself, be true to myself, and everything else is going to be okay. But that has taken a long time. And when I have those days, I call them the low self-esteem days, which I'll still have, I still have to be careful because I will still say yes when I mean no. And yes is a great thing. Saying yes to doing this is a great thing. But if I'm saying yes when I need to say no to take care of myself, then I actually am heading in the wrong direction for myself, because that can actually be heading towards relapse for me. Not necessarily relapse picking up a drug, but it can be relapse doing other things, like buying things I don't need. You know, I wish, I think Rashima said this, I wish I had gotten here and then everything was like fell into place and I didn't have to like work the steps over again after working the steps on my addiction. You know, I've had to work my steps on relationships and all kinds of stuff because I still look to the outside to make my insides feel good. And the outside can be all kinds of stuff. I didn't even realize the stuff you could look for outside. You know, but the longer you stay clean, the more you start realizing that there's so many things out there we can use to distract ourselves from really taking care of ourselves. The other part of my foundation, and I obviously wouldn't have a relationship with myself as far as I'm concerned without a relationship with my higher power. And that has been a process, and it continues to be a process. I was convinced at the age of 21 that I was going to hell. Okay, I mean, I really wish I was kidding about that, but I was absolutely convinced that it didn't matter because the things that I had done to get drugs, the things I had done to my family, getting my brothers and sister high for the first time, stealing, all those things, I don't even have to go into it. You all know what they are. You know, I did. And so that self-forgiveness that Rashima was talking about was so important. One of the first non-NA books I read was about forgiveness because there was so much shame and guilt. I had so much shame and guilt about what I had done that I really believe that if my first sponsor hadn't had me go through the steps quickly, with especially 6 and 7, that I probably would have used again. Sorry. Whew. You know, our medallion, on the top of our medallion, it has God, self, society, and service. And I was thinking, you know, how do you do the foundation thing? What do I share? You know what? Our medallion tells us how we do the foundation thing. It's right there on our medallion. And of course, those four things have a lot in each one of those topics. But you know, in the first couple pages of our book, it talks about, you know, the more we are hooked in to our higher power, the more we're taking care of self, the more that we're plugged into society, the more we're of service, the higher the base, the broader the base of our foundation, so the higher the freedom. And I think about freedom, and it's not just freedom from active addiction today for me. That's all we're promised, is freedom from active addiction. But I'm telling you, the freedoms I have today are way, way, way beyond just the freedom from active addiction. You know, I'm getting ready to finish my second master's. I came into NA with an 8th grade education. I did not understand a majority of the words in the basic text. I had a dictionary in my basic text. Simple words. And that is amazing. But I have also used my schooling to help with my self-worth. And I'm smart enough, now I'm done. And I have a bunch of friends in the front row that they do not believe me, okay? They do not believe me because they think I'm just going to find another program with a PhD this time. But truthfully, I can't afford it, okay? I have student loans that I'll be paying until I'm dead. I guarantee it. I won't be able to. Anyways, I don't know. Where am I at? Am I there? Oh. You know, my clean date is November the 29th, 1984. And I had an intervention done on me every time family members went into treatment. My mother first, then my youngest brother who died, Michael, then my sister, and then my other brother. They all invited me to the treatment centers. They were even going to let me go for free. I love my family. I love my family even in my active addiction. We are loving people. Take the chemicals out of us. We are awesome people. So they invited me to all these treatment centers. They literally would pull me into these rooms and say, we were talking to your whichever family member was in treatment, and they said there might be some issues for you. And Now, mind you, I used way a lot harder than my siblings did, and they knew it, and everyone knew it. And each time I would say, no, I have to be at work tomorrow. And I would proceed to leave those treatment centers. And I remember each time leaving those treatment centers, and most of the time, I would have drugs in my car, whatever I had at the time. But I remember when my Mark went into treatment. He's my brother that's still alive, and he was the last family member before I went in to go into treatment. And I remember they invited me to stay. I got in my car, and I had nothing in my car. I remember that feeling even to today because it's one of the hardest feelings I ever had to get through. And I remember at that point I'm in my ashtray and I have the little teeny roaches about this big, like a whole bunch of them in my ashtray. And I'm like driving down the road, down 15 and out of Leesburg. If anyone knows that, it's like a really windy, dangerous road. And I'm like got my lighter and these little roaches and I'm just trying to get high, desperately trying to get high. Desperately trying to get high. And I'll share this and then I'll finish up. The end of my addiction was scraping cocaine off of a bathroom floor. I didn't care about the dirt. I snorted that cocaine and then went back to my dishwasher job at the bar restaurant I worked at because I know no one can relate to this, but working at restaurant bars is like ideal for addicts. Ideal. The alcohol is right there. People sell drugs readily all around. It's just awesome. You know what I mean? You don't even have to go anywhere. You just go to work. So I snort that cocaine off that dirty floor, and I go to the dishwasher, and I look to my left, and my mother is standing in the screen door. At this point, my mother has going on 3 years, I guess. And within about 48 hours of that, I finally said the words that continue to be so, so important in my life, and that is, I need help. And today, I still have to remember, I need help. Sometimes, there's cracks in my foundation today. And when there's cracks in my foundation, it means I have work to do. Because cracks in the foundation mean relapse to me, because it means I'm not doing one of those things, those many things that we talk about that we think are so simple but can sometimes be so difficult. So I've had too many times in my life remember that I have to keep working on my recovery. It doesn't matter how much time I have to keep doing the basic things that you all taught me to do from the very beginning. Otherwise, if I don't pick up, I'm going to start using something else outside of myself to feel better about who I am. And thank you, and I hope everyone has a great convention. I'll keep coming back.
Thank you again, Linda and Rashima, for sharing your message with us. There is still some time left for the meeting, therefore we can open it up. Before we do that, for anybody who would like to share, please remember to come up to the podium one at a time and also keep in mind that there might be other people who want to share. So if anybody has something...